after I left, he did. I didn't know. I can use tonight.
You see, Suzanne can do this just well the second time. She should do the first. The postman come and stayed 3 hours.
You didn't have it on. And then you don't have to hold the microphone. Like Rick. With Bob, what he say here?
I know. Okay.
But you're always away when they come.
I'm always away, yeah. Well, I met him the first day. You brought up the chain for the post. It's a great big chain about like that, you know, welded together. It's a mailbox. He bought himself a brand new mailbox and a stencil. It says B. Harrell, Route 3, Ball Ground, Georgia. And he set it up. The postman came by the next day, Mr.
Weaver.
Carter, something new. I remember his name. Anyway, he came by and he told View it was too high. It has to be 38 inches, you know, so he can lean out and stick the mail. Well, he stopped and View said he said something about his wife running away. Just kind of mentioned it. And he had a boy. So, Jim and I went into town, and that night, View said he came by. They're getting ready for bed. View was in bed in the trailer. And he said he'd come by the top gate, and it was locked. But he saw the cars. So he drove around to the second gate by the mailbox, and he just climbed over and came in to visit. You know? So Nell said she got View some clothes put on, and he came out, and he said he'd stay for a couple hours just talking. And we had driven up the hill with our load of sawdust. And he stopped and he said, we had a visitor last night. He said, Suzanne, you would have liked him. He said, he talked for 2 hours. He said, you should have been here. I've already got a reputation. So, anyway, he said, this fella, he said, the mailman came by. And he said, he stayed and he talked and he says, I think he's a little screwy. He's just kind of funny. He's all right. He's a nice fellow, but he's just a little bit, I think he's nuts.
But, and he had on that?
Yeah, he was standing up there. He and Nell have been working. They get up, View gets up about 6 o'clock and builds a fire. You know, he gets started early. And he wears his hat and it makes him look different. You know, just, I've never seen him in a hat. It's a straw brim.
With a green.
Yeah, with a green visor on it.
Yeah.
He had the hammer in one hand, the nail apron around him. He just stopped and he showed Jim and I where to unload the sawdust. And he just started telling us about the fellow and what all he said. He said he sat down and without saying much at all, just started telling, you know, about he had this boy and he'd raised him by himself since he's 8 years old. And Nell said, well, I hadn't met him. I just thought he meant his wife had died. So she said something, you know, about being sorry that, you know, he had the boy by himself. And he says, well, my wife ran off with the paving man. Just bump. And Nell broke in. She says, I've never heard anything like it. Does somebody you don't even know just come up and tell you all their personal, you know, history and all like that? She says, I've never heard anybody doing something like that. She says, I never heard of it either, but he sure did. He told us all about his boy, and he said he'd been getting a road in to a new house he's building, just like we are. And he had a crew from Canton to put in the paving, and with the crew was his young man, good looking, and he says, I knew he's a fast talker right off. And he says, my wife ran off with him. She said, we hadn't had any problems, you know, no big trouble between us. We've been married 13 years. And I'm not saying we didn't have any spats, but we didn't have any big problems. And he says, I went off and came home one day, and there was a note she'd run off. The whole time, it just tickled him to death that this man sat there and told him all that. And Bew was about to freeze, he said. He didn't have any socks on, and he just... It's getting cold, and Bew gets so hot during the day, he cools off real quick when he gets cool. You know, he'll catch a chill. He said he's sitting there shivering and trying to listen, wishing he could go to bed. But he said the fella told him all about the wife had gone with this guy to Kentucky and lived with him for a while, and then he'd left her, and she got fed up and got a job, and this and that, and finally he talked her into coming back with him. I mean, the paving man talked her back into living with him. She found out he had a family in Kentucky and was married and had children. He'd been living with a woman in Georgia. She's still stuck with him. And the postman says it just came as a shock to him. He just all of a sudden hears this note from his wife, and she run off this fellow. So he raised the boy. And he said, he pulled out this picture. I mean, he said, he's a good looking boy. And he told Faye this, Faye was there. She hadn't been there either. She's with us. And all about how handsome he was and how much Faye really liked him. He said, Faye, you look just like a movie star or something. He's got two motorcycles, and his dad bought him a new car for graduation. And he's in college.
In college?
Yeah, just starting junior college. There's a little one right near us. And he wants to meet Faye. Well, and then he said, well, he's a little shy. And Mel said, well, Faye's a little shy, too. Faye got a little bit upset. She said, well, mother, she calls her when she's upset. Mother, you don't have to tell people that. Nell said, well, it's feminine to be shy. And she says, well, how come he's shy? Anyway, so he says he'd have to bring the boy over to meet Faye sometime. For Bew, this is okay because the mailman's been a lawyer. And he's got a college education, and his boy's going to college, and they go to church. The boy joined the church, went up at the invitation at the end of the service. He told all about that, he said. The day before his 10th birthday. And that's when he joined the church. So Bew's all in favor of Faye meeting this fellow.
Yeah. And but, the mail guy has been a lawyer.
Yeah, he was a lawyer in Macedonia. It's a little town about 10 miles northwest of us, and it's just a little tiny. It's the town that has all the mule and horse auction barns. And he said he was too tender-hearted to be a lawyer. He just couldn't pull the kind of tricks lawyers are supposed to pull. So he got a job in the postal service. He said in those days you had to kind of know somebody. That's all you needed. Just somebody speak for you. He got a job as a mail carrier, and that's what he's been doing ever since, and he likes it fine. He says he just has his church work and goes around and visits and stops and talks to you by your mailbox if you want to. Jim and I drove behind him one morning. We were just going into town. And he'd wave and grin and all. But Mel said, I think what he's going to be up here next to do is invite us to church.
Oh.
Because she said, well, I've seen this. Everybody goes to church. I told you before, at noon, you get every channel. There's a religious, a Bible program on. And churches are full Friday night, Saturday night, and all day Sunday. And just every little one you pass, you just got cars out in front of you.
Isn't that nice?
Jesus Name of Prophecy Church and Holiness of God Church and Chalcedonia Baptist Church. They're all Baptist.
Yeah.
But it's okay if Faye meets this boy, but the Hobart boy is down the street. She can't have anything to do with them. He don't care for them at all. Because they're wild.
Well, how did you get in touch with the oldest one?
Wayne? Well, he just shows up. They're helping. The fella across the road from us is building the house, and he hired the Hobarts to do it, you know, to dig the foundation for him. So they dug, and they dug, and they dug, and they hit rock. And they told Ronnie, and he says, well, we can't go any deeper. We hit rock. Ronnie's the kind of fella who say, well, it's on rock. It'll be okay. Mm-hmm. So they put up their basement on this rock, and sure enough, it rained, and the house slipped. And there went his foundation, a couple, I guess, quite a bit of money. So he hired him back again and got him to fix it up, you know, and realign it and level it and all. Well, they want Vue to hire them to do some work. The father is a carpenter, and the two boys, the two oldest boys, just do this and that. He's worked all around the cattle ranches and the lumber mills and stuff like that. Just summer jobs, mostly.
Oh.
He's just 20.
Yeah.
And he's been in the Navy for a while. And, he worked for one cattle man and, you know, breaking horses, I guess.
Yeah.
Or something. Anyway, he's rough when he handles animals. Anyway, he just came over one time. He wanted to know if Vue wanted any of the pasture bush hog. And Jim said, well, he didn't know, not right away. We let him know. And he just stays and talks. And this is the boy Nell was so worried about, because she knew he'd been married. She just wasn't sure if he was still married. And he was awfully helpful to them one day, offering to carry their water back and all, and favors with her. And just a little too helpful, she thought. First chance she got, she asked Daryl, was he still married? And Daryl said, yeah, he's married. And kind of eased things off.
Oh, you mean Wayne is married?
Yeah, Wayne's married.
Oh.
Wayne is wild. He's just wild.
He's down the, you know, 80 miles an hour.
Yeah, he goes down this long road, and it's got a couple of blind curves in it. Just as fast as he can go and just as drunk as he can get. Just as often as he can do it. He's torn up a couple of cars of his own. And the other day, he got arrested. He said he got a $1,500 bond for doing 97 and 35 miles on his own. He's trying out Ronnie's car, see how fast he'd go. This is the second time. The first time it only been $1,000. This time it's $1,500. So he comes over and he sits around and he talks. And he started out asking us, did we like to swim? Did we like drag races? Do we like baseball? You know, just all these things to do around ball ground. And Jim sort of would listen, but not too encouraging, because he knew his father didn't want Faye to have much to do with him. You know, I'd be a little encouraged. I want to hear all this stuff. And then he'll talk about all these people he's worked for or just had run-ins with. And he's had run-ins with all of them. The fella he's worked for, Jake somebody. And Jay Roper down the road has got the foxhounds. He's the alcoholic and the atheist and anything else you can think of. He runs his hounds every night.
Can you hear him?
Not in the summer, in the fall, winter.
Oh, yeah.
He's always losing them. He said he went one time, he's so bored he thought he'd die. He says, but I think Jay goes up there and drinks, and that he loses his dogs. He always comes home two or three dogs short. Doesn't bother him, he just gets some more. And Jay Roper lives in a great big old house with yellow boards on it. With the porch around three sides, a couple old barns in the back. And he's got a wife, I know. I see her sitting out on the porch. But he talked about him a little bit, and just anybody. And He says it fell down the road that bootlegs beer and whiskey in the county. And you can get it from him. And I think Wayne does a little bit of beer running himself. The other day, he came over, he said, did y'all find some beer cans around your mailbox? I said, yeah, you found a couple. One of them was full. He said, well, there's about 11 more down there. He said, there's a car behind me, and I wasn't sure it wasn't a police. He'd been drunk, and they'd come around the hill and just throw the beer cans out the window.
Oh.
And he says, the hill that comes down the north side of the land, there's two roads that cross, and our land meets at the corner. It's a slope about like that, and it starts way, way on up, about a mile up the road. And I came down on the motorcycle, coasting at 40 miles an hour. He says he gets to the top of that hill and revs his car up and just comes down the hill, you know. And just as he gets to the corner, he'll slam on the brakes and the car will spin around. He says it spins around. He got spun around four times one time, he said, before it went up and ran into the fence. Tore his fence down. He had to put it up the next day. But anyway, that's why Bew doesn't want Faye to have too much to do with the Hobart family. Daryl's the same way, only he tears up motorcycles instead of cars.
But now, he worked for the man with the dogs, Roper?
He didn't work for him. He just caught one of his dogs one time way back in the woods while he was hunting. And carried the dog all the way back to Roper, and Roper thanked him and said, you know, as Wayne put it, he says, thank you so much. You've done such a good thing to bring me my dog back. I want to reward you. Why don't you come hunting with me Saturday night? Wayne says, well, thank you, Mr. Roper, but I believe I'll just let that go. Because he doesn't like hunting. He wanted money, you know, naturally.
He'd always be just a little short of money.
Oh, yeah, just a little.
Yeah.
You start paying those kind of bonds, you're just a little short of money.
Good Lord, yeah.
That's why, you know, he wants just a couple of jobs for Bew to get him, you know, like cutting the pasture, helping with the building, or laying blocks or whatever. I guess he knows how to do some of this stuff. You know, he knows quite a bit, but...
He's your closest neighbor.
Yeah, they're sort of catty corner.
That's where they got stuck in the truck for him. Yeah. Right out there, close to Hobart.
They've got that big house they have, or had. Two daughters are married. There's Wayne, Daryl, and Barbara, and four other children. All boys. The youngest one's five, I think. All in that family, and you can hear them. And you can hear them when they get to handle the cattle at night, in the evenings, too. Change them. Quite a commotion. Oh, yeah, yeah. You hear that first, and then all the cattle start coming in toward the barns and the pens. Yeah, and talking.
Cattle, when they move, I guess they always talk.
I think so, because you can always tell when they're being fed up there. They'll start at one end of the pasture and you hear them move away from you going up.
And it's sound traveling.
Oh, yeah.
And those hills.
Well, it's close.
This is Channel 1, right around 300. And this is the end of the first little report. Suzanne on her second visit from Georgia. This Sunday, I guess it is, the 16th of July, 72, Channel 1 right, around 300, and this is the end of Suzanne's first little report on the mailman. She didn't see him herself, is reporting through a Buell. This Channel 1 right, around 300, the end of this first little visit report of Suzanne with Rick and Faye and me, this Sunday, the 16th of July, 72.
We'd sell his pieces for like $1,500, $2,000.
Oh.
And so he bails out after several confrontations, I suppose, with galleries and people and four or five wives and a few things like that. The first time I see him, he's wandering around the streets of Micanopy, and I'm wondering where this woodsman has come from. He's got a scraggly beard, all Levi clothes, you know. And he comes up and says, "Is there any boys here in the shop?" Sort of almost talks with a lisp. And he's got a finely perfected brogue accent, southern accent. But at any rate, he owns a piece of land up in on the Santa Fe River, I think it's Santa Fe. Well, no, Suwannee. Doesn't make much difference. He calls it Land of Goshen. And he's developed this down-to-earth, next-to-nature type affair, which people can stay there if they pay $1 a day and work 4 hours. And the type of work they do is all handwork. See, if they're going to get a stump out of the ground, they got to grub that stump out of the ground. They're not going to have blasting or pull it with a tractor or get a caterpillar out to go ahead and clean the land up and forget about it. And old Jack Sanders goes over there for the big 4th of July weekend. He'd been once before, but he came back and he's complaining bitterly. Man, he says, "I ain't going to have none of that Turtle Adam stuff." He said, "Seems to me that the good Lord done made some of this stuff for us to use, and if we don't use it, we're damn fools." He said, "That guy's out there working all day long doing nothing." And Jack didn't understand that for hell, you know, that this guy would just bust his neck out there just to get a stump out of the ground. He says if he wants the experience, he said he's going to have enough trouble moving the stump around after it's out of the ground. He went on about that. Man, he was disgusted. He said, finally, I just said, "To hell with it," and I got in my own groceries and went off and camped by myself. I wouldn't have anything to do with it. So that's his opinion of non-electricity, Jack Sanders. He certainly doesn't believe in
that. Well, you know, that happened long ago. You know, after the tractors and all got in here, you couldn't hire anybody to do it with a hoe or with a mule. Nobody just will go back.
Yeah.
Even if you pay them money.
Yeah.
You gotta get fools who'll pay money to do it.
Well, this Adam Turtle's getting them to do it for nothing, see, doing that. See, I don't know. It's sort of a strange thing. Funny,
who is this Mizell Wade?
Tuck Mizell. He's my favorite businessman. He's the one that owned the tractor, the trailer that I wrecked, and I owned the cab. And we've always had a real good relationship. He's Jack Durrance's partner, the county commissioner. Or Jack Durrance is his partner. He does all the work, and Jack Durrance does all the politicking. That's the way that goes. He's seldom ever in the office. He's always out politicking.
Yeah.
And I don't know what advantage he is to that office other than getting them political payoffs on jobs and stuff. Primary.
Yeah.
I don't think he contributes much office work at all. And Tuck does it all. He's one of these, when I knew him, he'd be at work at 5 in the morning, sometimes 4.
Yeah.
And I think he's cut down a little bit on that. He's got a long history with me. Not direct, but we on and off contact each other.
Yeah.
And he always says, "Wade, you're crazy as hell." You know, when we get through talking, and "Wade, I sure do like you, but you're crazy as hell." You know, and I try. It's really
he's honest about it.
Oh yeah, he's honest about it. He just knows I'm absolutely crazy as hell, but he really likes me. You know, really likes me.
Well, you put up with a few things in your friends.
Yeah. It's a funny thing. I went over to talk to him about a little project that my brother and I are up to, which is essentially developing a total environment for kids that are 16 to 21 years old. Sort of a simple thing to do. And by the way, it looks like it might get off the ground, too. So I thought it'd be a good thing to do one in Alachua County. This is being done up in Maryland, sort of a long-distance job. And approaching Tuck about this, and his concern, see, with these kids that sort of have nowhere to go, nothing to turn to, and they're disgruntled with their parents and with the establishment and with the school and everything. And they just fall out. And the only thing they can do is turn to the street. And the day I went to talk to him about it, I'll be damned. I said, Tuck, you seem to be sort of down today. It was over the phone. I could catch it, man. He was really down. He said, well, Wade, I had a little bit of problem in my house. I said, what's that? I said, my son's best friend just shot himself to death in my bedroom last night.
Good
Lord. Damnedest thing. And his son was up on a dope charge the year before, mm-hmm. and this kid was on a dope charge. And the year before, I'd gone out and had dinner at the country club with Tuck, and was trying to talk to him about some of the rationale behind, if you want to call it that, behind what these kids are doing, see? Some sort of a communicative situation so that maybe he could understand the kid a little bit more and at least talk to him rather than fight him all the time, you know? And he just wouldn't let any light through, none at all, you know, so that he could possibly come reestablish a connection with that son. And then this year, that other kid, which is son of some substantial person in town, you know, went and wiped out in Tuck's bedroom now, or the kid's bed, it's Tuck's house.
That's too close.
Yeah. Oh, it's very odd because this is precisely the people that my brother and I were concerned with in the project. Those people that they had nowhere to go, and they were taking care of this kid until such a time as Tuck's son got in trouble with this boat business too. So they had to separate him because they're both on parole. See, and they were best of friends, but they had to separate him, and there's nowhere to turn. See, nothing to handle these kind of people.
Now that's Tuck's boy.
Yeah. Now he didn't. It was his friend that shot himself.
Yeah.
And but still, through all of this, I can go back to him with the same proposition, and he will say, "Well, I think at that time he said, well, Wade, I think we run a danger if we start putting these people together too much, and such things as that. You talk about change and opposition to it. These people are really opposed to change.
Yeah.
they don't want to get these kids together. They might explode, see.
Oh.
They're going to leave them around in detention homes here and kids there and disgruntled parents. Tell you.
They can do less harm separated if they got together.
That's their feeling,
yeah.
About it. Rather than allowing the kids to get together in an environment in which they can have some sort of help and work their problems out together. We weren't talking about putting all same type of people together. We had it worked up into percentages and stuff like that, so balance out the program.
So Mizell just stays in the office?
Most of the time. Mm-hmm. Catching there almost any time. He's good soul. Just a rich person. I mean, he's just as pleasant and always seems to have time for somebody and seems to be understanding about things. But I'll be damned. I don't know what causes a mind to be so blunt and yet have a, like he's really strong with his church, the Episcopal Church downtown, and firmly believes in this. Matter of fact, he made some statements that the kid was doing very well in Sunday school before he shot himself. Which, I mean, he still believed he was doing well in Sunday school, but still shot himself. And, just some indications. One day I came back from truck driving. This was before I was driving his rig. And I'd been gone for about a year or so. And I'd picked up a lot of information around the country. And I said, Tuck, tell you what, I've got a program. Says, I've got a friend up in Morgantown, Pennsylvania that'll come down here for free if we just wine and dine him, give him a good vacation, take him fishing, and he'll do all the engineering and set up the whole program for us to install a cable TV company. Now, I'll sell my truck and take the money and put it in, and I'll work for nothing. And you put up the rest of the capital we need to get started, and we'll get something going. He says, nah, man, that's fishy. Says, I wouldn't have anything to do with that.
It's
a damn gold mine now. This was 2 years before the person made application, see, for a town permit to put in cable television game for. And the very next summer, the crazy guy goes and puts $10,000 in those coffee machines that I was working for him, and lost every penny of it.
In what?
In coffee, in these little coffee machines that we were putting these various shots.
Oh yeah.
Oh.
Lost every blasted penny of it. Never got returned one. What is this? Is that coffee?
That's coffee.
Okay.
I take it out of the big jar because people leave the lid off of it. And it's, if they leave the lid off of this, it's not much loss. You see, that's my attitude toward human nature.
I sure understand that. That's the best way to control it. Sure is.
I have dealt with some shady characters.
Leave the lids off.
They really stretch your face. Now, was Mizell the one? I thought that was Durrance that was going down to the meeting. They were going to have a committee meeting and work out this religious business that you told me about a long time ago.
That would have been Mizell.
Right?
Yes.
And you said something, and he said, "The hell, I don't want. We just gonna do it tonight, or something like that."
I'm trying to bring that back, because he said some funny things to me along those lines, you know. And it's he'll consider this stuff, but he won't absorb it.
Yeah.
It doesn't seem to go all the way in, but like he has an inkling now about that. What Askew and McGovern are talking about is this underneath him. He feels it, but it still ruffles his feathers.
Yeah.
He sort of sees it coming, you know, but he's still got it back up.
Yeah.
And like I was talking to him about the same thing a couple of years ago, and he couldn't catch a glimmer of it. Not the first one. That's when he told me I was crazy as hell.
He wants to hear that old rhetoric.
I think it. You reckon that's it? They got to have that power and the.
You know, well, I felt the same thing when Ribicoff got up there. And he talked like a Sunday school teacher.
Uh oh.
He's the one that announced, nominated,
Engelhardt? Whatever, Engelhardt?
No,
I don't know.
Vice President, the President.
Oh,
McGovern.
Yeah, yes. But he didn't sound like a nominating speech.
That's true, Guy. It just occurred to me, those people in Micanopy, if somebody doesn't come out and hand them rhetoric, they say, hell, he's not a politician.
That's right.
That's probably why people like Humphrey, he can do it. He's got that flair.
Yeah.
And Barbara just swore off of him because of it. He's just too much like an old politician. That's all he is, just a politician, not a statesman, a politician.
Yeah.
Jesus, what?
That raindrop out there that looks like a Christmas tinsel.
Caught some.
You don't see it.
You have to catch it in front. I saw one out there one time.
Yeah.
Just sparked, sparked.
It's as big as a hen egg.
It's a healthy raindrop.
It is. Well, after all, it could be, isn't it? Yeah. Now you're looking the wrong way.
I think I see.
You see
it's
one?
It looks like it's down the pine tree.
Well, this is on the other. Well, anyhow. Wait, that Chuck Mizell. So you actually never have gotten very far with Tuck.
I have no way of knowing.
Yeah.
They, the two of them, now it's hard to determine which it comes from, Tuck or Durrance, about the manner in which they run their business. See, that's one of the reasons I never get along too well in the business world, because first day I'm there, I'm criticizing everything that's going on. See, I'd come off the road running my own rig, and even though I didn't make any money, I was more competent than any of the guys locally about doing the whole process. Loading, packing, handling bills, driving, backing, the whole works, because I had to do it all. these guys, one couldn't drive, the next couldn't do this, the next couldn't do that. They're all colored guys, see. And they were paying us the large sum of $1.10 an hour. And they paid me $1.10 an hour, and they paid them $1.10 an hour. And I had to take the whole responsibility of meeting the movers, getting the paperwork done, making sure everything was loaded, load it myself, make it packed, deliver it, get it signed, drive the truck, gas the truck, the whole thing. These other guys sit there and sleep during these other processes when you didn't have to yell at them to take a piece of furniture off. And on top of that, Jack Durance made me shave my beard off so I'd be more presentable. And these spades would come in there drunk, good Lord Almighty, you know, the clothes would be all hanging off of them, you know, and they'd come in and show up for work at 7 in the morning, you know. And I came in, stood right next to him, sort of dapper and clean. That's when I had all my hair cut off and I had a little goatee. And it just ruined him. He couldn't stand it. He says, you're going to have to shave that off. It's a bad image for the company. So I caught him with a mustache and he got it back.
Did it?
Yeah. I caught him right flat with a mustache. And they had some of those guys that they'd use them, the company store type thing. They'd pay them a dollar dime an hour. They knew their habits, and they worked some of them by the day. And the company always stood good for a touch. See, the guy they'd go bail them out of jail. They knew most of them would get in jail once in a while. They'd get in trouble with non-child support or whatever. They'd shell out a few bucks to them. These guys always knew that they could get a modest advance on pay. They're not, you know, they're always going to need that. We have a kinship. This thing of being nigger rich is something else. And so they ran the company like that, paying them the lowest possible amount of money, but giving them all these amenities, which don't work out to be an amenity at all, you know, because they're not paying them a living wage. And that's the way Jack Durance operated. And I don't know how much of a finger that Tuck had into it at all. See, it was beyond me, my comprehension, how they could do that and not get totally wealthy doing it, because the company operates under schedule book set by the ICC. And they have two tariffs. One is from a high tariff area and one is from a low tariff area. And those tariffs vary only 15%. The high tariff area would be like in San Francisco. Well, I went out to San Francisco and hired helpers, and if you have a piano or some heavy load, you have to hire two of them. You have to hire them at a minimum of 8 hours, no matter how much you have to unload. And they may work 1 hour and get paid for eight, and they get paid five something an hour.
Wow.
And the same, there's a 15% higher tariff out there than it is here. And I'm yet to understand the differential. That's the reason when they talk to me about balancing budgets, especially like Tuck Mazell, it just won't work, he'll say. Well, hell, how come he hadn't just been getting filthy rich, you know? And if he hasn't, I don't think he really has, to tell you the truth. I don't think he's really made that much money, but he should have, because there should be some differential involved in it. Well, actually living in San Francisco, unless you desire to throw away all of your money, is not that much more expensive than living in Gainesville, Florida.
Oh, no.
Loaf of bread's the same, practically. The standard grocery item's the same. Rent's a little higher. But the throwaway money is there available for you. You can throw away money on everything. You can't go around the corner like New York City. You know, you just can't walk out on the street without throwing your money away. But it's the same. If I load up in San Francisco, the rate says it's only 15% more. But yet the cost, the labor people get approximately five times as much, plus they get all these guarantees. And still the companies make money on it. See, they have to pay their men like that, their drivers. But there's something that doesn't really jive together about it, and that's why that whole money thing is so strange. that these people probably make a similar profit to the people in San Francisco, and they should be making five times as much profit.
Well, you mean because they don't have to pay the labor costs?
No.
Like they pay in San
Francisco. But they charge as much.
They charge the same cost, yes.
But they don't have to pay as much for labor, so they ought to be, yeah, I see what you mean.
And just stay out of San Francisco.
It's really amazing. First time I ran into that was in Pittsburgh, and I came back one day, and I had for two men, I had a $80-something labor bill, and I almost collapsed. It's like I'd work 8 hours down here and get $9. And they rode for 3 hours of that. Slept. Good God. They do that to you and smile.
Yeah.
Those funniest ones are in New York, the workers. There you come, especially if you're sort of a younger driver, not too experienced. The warehouse will assign you two workers. And these guys, they pick up the papers, and they get in your truck, say, okay, let's go. So you say, go down there, and turn here. They're generally sort of chubby guys, you know, with the knit cap on, you know, and jolly faced. All right, go pull over, park over there. And you're looking around, and he says, don't think that's the address. And he says, okay, let's get out. You get out, and they go sit down and have some coffee. They don't ask you about it. They tell you where to go, and you sit down and you have coffee with them. See, and you're paying, like I'm paying them, see. It's my money. And the whole time, man, they have absolute control in this New York City. And I know you'd have to do an awful lot of work and being it a long time to be able to come back on those fellows. Because, I mean, you have to stand in fear. They just run you to death. And then I remember one time that the shipper gave me a monster tip. And they didn't leave me any of that tip. They took it all themselves. They took it from me. They're really funny people. That's the New York spirit.
And you can't sidestep them.
Oh no, not if you want to get your work done. You know they have to report you back and blackmail you and blackball you or whatever they call it. And, you know, they've got the upper hand there.
You don't know where you're going though.
No, not New York. You don't know how to deal with anybody either. You know, a fellow from out of New York. I imagine the person who grew up in New York would know how to yell back at them. You got to be able to fight. Sure do. And they do all kinds of things, like when you're taking shortcuts through a bar and they'll take a drink while going back to the truck. And when you come in way downstairs in the big hotels and things, they'll go get a quick beer on the way and come back and take something back upstairs. Sure do you in. That New York City has always just intimidated me totally. I feel like drying up when I'm there and disappearing.
It makes you wonder how they ever got the skyscrapers up.
Oh. I mean, it's so horrible to go try to get a bite to eat and get yelled at for eating, you know, by the people that are selling you the food. I never could understand that. I never could understand it. I mean, they open the business to serve people food, and they yell at you if you come to buy it. What do you want? And growl at you. So I just wanted to eat. Hurry up. Yeah, I think I'd expire if I didn't stay there. Couldn't handle it. Strange people.
Wait, when you worked with the with this photography you've done, now is that for the architects, the builders? Who is it you worked with?
It would be the three groups, primarily builders, architects, and magazines. And the magazines use it for their publication,
yeah,
which is, in a sense, sales, selling. And the architects, when they commission it, they do it for two reasons. One is for their brochure work, to make brochures or make exhibits or have photographs of their work so that they can mail it out to prospective clients who are asking them what they've done and this kind of thing. And they use it to enter into competition, state and national competitions, and display their pictures, or either submit small ones and they judge it ready for competition, and they make big ones and make up boards and display them. And also, if they feel like the building is pretty good building, they'll submit it to various magazines for publication, which is just further recognition. And they then will get, I mean, through recognition, they get a return on income because more people know them. Hiya, Faye. And that's the meat of their business. You've got to get known to really get big. And this guy Bill Morgan over in Jacksonville is—he's made it on their own publications primarily. He got landed a tremendous condominium up in Oceanside, Maryland, just on by virtue of his work being printed in the magazine. Man just walked into his office. I saw it. I like it. I want to hire you. This is a multi-million dollar project. I've forgotten. It was probably over $5 or $8 million, something like that. It's just a half chance type thing. It's really, that's another one of my disillusionments, because it's a degenerative process as far as quality is concerned. It turns into like the American car, in which the model change happens to be not something that makes it run better, but in one more strip of chrome, you know, curlicue on the back end,
mm-hmm.
you know, and another knob on the nose, and said, look at our fine new car. It gets your attention a lot better. And that's why it's degenerative for these architects to have to work this way, because their work gets acclaimed by recognition, and generally it's seldom ever on the functionality of this thing. It's on an arbitrary aesthetic that is established by a group of magazines and a group of end people that say, well, this type of work is really good, so they publish it. Like Paul Rudolph, that started in Sarasota, he put about 80% of his budget into publications. I mean, of his profit. He lived on beans. He put everything he made into having pictures made. He'd pay Ezra Stoller to come down and photograph his stuff. And you had to photograph it right on the button, too, because 3 days later it was falling apart. He did the Sarasota High School. It just got a fantastic amount of publicity, being a rather far-out, innovative design work. And a year later, it was leaking all over. Some of the big plate glass windows had fallen in. And the concrete is cracking and sliding around. And in the hallways, the heat was running right at 110 degrees. And so they had a citizens committee meeting, and they called him back down. And by that time, he'd gone on virtue of this building almost. He escaped to New York, so he's out of Sarasota. And they got him down, and I was talking to this one fellow that went to the meeting to see what was happening. And Rudolph, really, he's not a public person. He can't speak publicly at all, but evidently he did quite well this time. His father was a minister. I don't know why he couldn't pick up some of his father's rhetoric, but he mumbled and bumbled something fierce in public. And so they had him on the carpet up there, and they were throwing all these barrages at him of this, that, and the other. And finally he came up with one statement saying, well, geez, I sure did the best I could on that building. I thought it was a fantastic building. It, by the way, have any of you ever seen it from the air? It's beautiful. The configuration from the air is just fine. And I don't know what happened in the halls there. I sure didn't mean to make those little buggers sweat like that. And he said two or three more things, and the people left without really giving him any more hell. After all, he was one of the nation's number one architects, and he had taken the trouble to come down from New York and confront this irate group of people. It's really amazing. Evidently, he has two. He's born in Alabama or something, and he's got these two old maid sisters too. And he's a bachelor, married to his work. He's got these two old maid sisters that are just straight Alabama hicks, and they come to visit him, you know. And he tries to find somebody to go take them off and hide them. They say, I don't know why Paul wants to do something like that. And they go by and see these buildings he's done. I don't know what's the matter with that boy. He wants to do building like that. That's no building. I would like to have seen that. Because he's like one of the, he really is the foremost, you might say, single designer. He's still not a, I mean, he does the design work. Most all other big companies have design staffs and things of this nature. But, I mean, his own personal influence. And it, to do what he's doing in sort of a very advanced manner and then have these two old maid backwoods sisters to be with him, that's really nice. I don't know what's the matter with Paul. Doing that crazy stuff. But all these guys are terrible autocrats. These foremost designers. They really are. This Bill Morgan is just god awful. You talking about a one way street, you got it with him.
All coming in.
Well, coming in from him. You don't ever talk to him. There's no way. No way to carry on a conversation. If you've got something you want said, you just like the little kindergarten guy who wants to go to the bathroom and you finally wet your pants and leave. I've tried to say something to him. And he'll talk your ear off, and you think, oh, well, I've got an opening. I'm going to try to get into this man a little bit and try to say something reasonable to him, you know, like maybe what's going on in your world. It just goes, pchoom, just skips right off. He'll say, far out, you know. Then he'll get right back on what he's talking about, which is his business. And I think he got sort of a little bit drunk with me one time and told a couple of funny stories. And I really enjoyed him when he got off his subject. He was funny, but good Lord, when he gets on that business thing, he's terrible. He just rats it like a bulldog. His wife works with him. He's the mainstay of the outfit. And he's just all promotion straight down the line. And it runs right in his head, that business world and the attainment of his objectives of becoming a top designer. And everything is directed towards that. This whole environment. It's something I can't really contend with. And it's really hard working with people like that. He knows what he wants, and he's going after it, and he'll probably get it.
Well, you'd think that they depend so much on the pictures. You'd think the picture taker would get rich along with them.
They could if they had the right attitude. Sure, it would make quite a bit of money. I think an architectural photographer has to be a very strange person, or any good photographer. I mean, high quality work. Most photographers don't have any basis to have ability. The ones around here. Commercial guys, they don't have the mentality, or it's not been developed, to put it that way. They hardly know one thing from the other in the world, or they have no aesthetic basis, you know, nothing. They're just digging a ditch with a camera. That's all they know to do. But to get somebody that gets up a little bit, then they have to start contending with all the falderall that goes on with it, and that bothers them. You know, all the playing games with the business, and they can't get back down to work and taking pictures. So it's a problem there. And architectural photography is particularly demanding in with the weather conditions and timing and the logistics of the whole thing of being there when the client wants you there, being there when the weather's right, And then a lot of times they forget to notify the building owners. And you the best example of that it happened down in Englewood, Florida, which happens to be pretty much of a hick town anyhow. And they had some sort of annual rodeos there and things. And I think it was Englewood, but anyhow, I was doing a whole scope of things for one architect down in Fort Myers. And he flew up, had a plane fly up and get me and an assistant. And we flew down there, and he had his PR girl to go with us. And we got their car, and we had these things all mapped out and planned out. And we were going to hit them at certain times and take so many pictures of each. And the weather was holding for us all right, so we could make it. And we were late for one or something like that. And we'd done quite well. We're almost on schedule. We missed meeting somebody at a high school, so we couldn't get inside there. We came back to this bank, and the girl went in to ask permission, and the guy that was with me was redheaded and had a small red beard and modest hair, and I had my beard and modest hair. And this girl was a very straight girl, you know. She's a nice-looking young lady. And she more or less got permission. It took her a long time. They had to call up, call back to Fort Myers and make sure that the architect had commissioned us to take one picture inside and one outside, see, of this crazy, ugly bank. So finally she got permission. She came back outside. And that was I didn't know it then, but that was the vice president that she went through all this. So I walked into the bank with our big parade, me carrying the monster camera, you know, and the red carrying the bag. And so we come rushing in the door, and nobody said anything to us. They stood all stone-faced. This whole bank was that way. I've been in, you know, they joke with you and laugh and carry on, ask you what you're doing. Everybody was quiet, you know, deathly quiet. And that was the worst interior of a bank I've ever seen. It would put my house to shame as far as housekeeping is concerned. They had junk everywhere. They had one of these old, this is sort of a halfway modern bank now. And they had one of these old weighing machines that you put a penny in up by the door.
Oh.
They had their water fountain was a jug on the wire rack. Is there water set somewhere else? They had served coffee on some sort of a crazy tray with the tin foil, you know, over the tray.
Ah.
Set out there in the middle of the lobby with tin foil there and old wooden spoons hanging around and junk. So I thought, well, I've really got to do some house cleaning. So I set about moving things. They had some sort of a Chinese screen hiding their vault, which I had to get out of the way. And I was right in the midst of carrying something across the room, and I heard this voice boom out and say, "What are you doing?" I said, "Oh, just cleaning up." And I kept on going, "For what?" I said, "Oh, we're just taking pictures." I thought this was somebody else just walked in, wanted to know what was happening, see. And by God, it was the president. He said, "Just taking pictures." He says, "Get them out of here!" He yelled, and it just echoed all over the bank. They just yelled it out. "Get them out of here." So I got him calmed down enough. I said, "Look, I've almost got it set up. We got it all cleared." The vice president called up. I said, "Man, another 3 minutes. The camera's set over there. Everything's ready. Just 3 minutes." He's just fuming all over. I said, "You better hurry up, though." I got the picture, though. That was the damnedest thing. He'd come yell at me like that. "Get him out of here."
Englewood is a railroad crossing. Railroad yard.
Maybe it wasn't. No, was Englewood where we landed, or this was over on the coast?
Oh, on the coast.
So it wasn't Englewood. It was.
Englewood's right in the interior. I used to travel around down.
It's right close to Englewood, not too far up down the road from it, out towards the coast from Englewood. Yeah, that Englewood is the It's a rodeo town. They have a big rodeo affair there, and it's just an old, Florida, really South Florida town. It's not like, not at all like Micanopy. These towns up here, it's all spread out.
You haven't been thrown with the countryside at all.
Mm-mm.
With the backward element.
No, no.
Not at all. Even the backward businessmen, you haven't been. It's all the men who operate on the margin.
Yeah, but I sure do find out they're getting awful close together, these people. When they talk about business, I don't know. It's a strange thing.
You see, I haven't got into that world at all. It just scares me to death. I just couldn't make it. I just throw my hands up. But these fellas like to, it sounds to me like the old president down there that's wanting to get you out. He's been right in my element, I think.
Yeah, he no doubt came up from way back.
Yeah.
And worked.
Yeah.
Worked hard.
Yeah.
You know, and worried day and night. And never had a time to think about anything outside of that bank or his business. Not at all. Now, I don't know. The fellas you talk about it react the same way. Something strange comes in.
Well, let me tell you, I don't deal with them in the economic way, the business way, you see. And, they could give you trouble that way. I deal with them, I don't know in what terms. I listen to them. That's about all I do deal with them. And the one thing that you don't do with them is to do business with them. That's the one thing. That's where I've made my biggest mistakes, is trying to do business with them. Every time I do, I get hung up.
They're serious, and I hold it against you, too.
I don't know what it is. I just don't understand it. But now, Marvin, Miss Guthrie over there has got all this hay equipment. We've had it the same length of time, except they bought all the ass and you. And she told me when she bought that baler, she says, "Mr. Miles, your troubles are over." But I never got the baler over here. And after that, I quit. And I wouldn't even bring it up, you see. I wouldn't even look at it as if I was interested in it.
What kind of eye did you say that man had that came down here with those damn cows that time? You remember he put foot on the property, and next thing he knew, everything was there. Everything was there.
Yes. And so that's another thing. Just like Cookie, all of them are like that.
He knows everything.
Oh, yes.
Right immediately.
Oh, yes. Yes.
They might have a use for it. We don't know where it is.
Yes. They have that mentality, and it carries over to the equipment, you see. If you're using a baler out there, they look at it, and they see exactly how it works. And, you see, if the thing lifts up the way it did this morning, they wouldn't have to go over and look for the lift and put it back down like these morons do. They just go over there and push it down and look the other way on equipment they've never seen before. And that's the way they do. And they'll spoil you that way. But then you can't rely on them. There's absolutely no reliance in them. You can't pin them down when they'll come or anything.
Mm-hmm.
So...
it just reminded me of Buster. You know, Buster and Charlie Birch were standing out there, and we were talking about the high price of parts on automobiles. And I said, "Yeah, you know, these plugs are terribly expensive." Went down and asked for 8 plugs for a car, and they wanted $10 and something for 8 plugs at the parts place. And went out to JM Fields and got 8 plugs for $4.60, AC plugs. And the two of them broke out in huge guffaws.